Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever time you are listening to this, wherever you are listening to this. This is Greg Klein's Old School Wrestling Talk. My name is Greg Klein, your host, and today is episode number 7, The Gold Cup, as we return to talking about Nick Bockwinkel, in particular his matches in Houston, Texas, mostly defending the AWA World Heavyweight title, although in a few notable cases, wrestling either for other titles or for other honors, as we will talk about when we talk about the Gold Cup, one of two very special tournaments held in Houston at the Sam Houston Coliseum in 1981. And we'll start with a little bit of an intro from Bockwinkel himself, talking about a match set up for November 20, 1981 at the Sam Houston Coliseum.
Tito Santana, you have had a fortuitous moment where for a couple of weeks you have risen right up to the very top in your profession, and you stand alongside of me. And as far as I'm concerned, that trophy of 50 golden years is supposed to be mine. And it's a little bit tarnished because you've got your greasy mitts on it.
Yes. So that's a good setup, although we'll go back to the beginning of the year and work our way through the Gold Cup. We'll just say right up the bat that Greg Klein's Old School Wrestling Talk is sponsored by me and my professional work, my two books, which are out on Amazon, The King of New Orleans, the biography of Sylvester Ritter, aka the Junkyard Dog, and my first novel, The Paper Tigers, the untold true story of how eight guys from the streets of Philadelphia became professional baseball players for one day. A couple people bought that book in the last month. I imagine that it was listeners to this show, so thank you guys very much. And I will say that if you guys want an autographed copy, I'll send it to you for the same price, waive the shipping, and just, you know, let me know, PayPal me or whatever the case may be, and I'm happy to autograph it, personalize it if you like, and send it out rather than getting it to you from Amazon. But enough of the commercials. We've got a lot to talk about today. 1981 is a busy year in Houston wrestling. It's a busy year in the life of Nick Bockwinkel. And when we left off, it was 1979, and he had just defended the title. And I think the last match that he had was against Bruiser Brody. And actually, I saw a little aftermath of the match on Chris P. Lettuce's Google Drive, in which Harley Race is getting ready for his title match against El Halcón, and Brody won't leave the ring, which is actually pretty funny. He's got a chair. He's doing the Brody sit-down bit, which sometimes he did, you know, as a shoot, I guess you would say, when he was really angry with the promoter. He would just go in the ring and sit down in the middle of the ring. But this time, Harley Race tries to get him out. It's clearly an angle meant to set up a rematch with Harley Race, or a match with Harley Race, I guess you would say. And Brody pretty much savages Race before Race's title defense. And obviously Race successfully defended the title, but he does sort of get his butt kicked first by Bruiser Brody, who's angry that Nick Bockwinkel lost by disqualification, but did not lose the AWA World Heavyweight title to Brody. Another error and omission from previous episodes. I was talking about the Sheik as a non-white champion. And of course, that is true. He did consider himself not to be Caucasian. But I said that he was of Palestinian descent and was a Palestinian American. And he's actually of Lebanese descent and was a Lebanese American. Another thing that I was talking about last month was, why was Harley Race on an episode of Mid-South Wrestling? And sure enough, as I speculated, Harley Race was at a Superdome show not long after Mid-South shows a Florida or Georgia match of Harley Race against Terry Taylor. And what we think is Terry Taylor's first appearance in Mid-South, albeit as a jobber, losing to Harley Race in a good match. I also wanted to do a shout out to my boy, my mentor, Jerry Gray. His mom, Ellen, recently died, so my condolences to him. When I last messaged with him and expressed those thoughts to him. He said that his mom was his life and his biggest supporter. And I know how much that meant to him. My grandmother was my life and my biggest supporter while she was alive. We actually just passed the 20th anniversary of her death. So, you know, my heart goes out to Jerry, and I say a little prayer for his mom that she's in a better place and her suffering is over. And let's remember her as a blessing, as you would say. So with that out of the way, I want to talk about Nick Bockwinkel in Houston again. As I said last episode, the Nick Bockwinkel episode 5 was our most downloaded episode, at least from the direct downloads. And I've heard a lot of people talk about how they too are fascinated with Bockwinkel, how maybe they didn't appreciate him in the 80s when they saw him in the AWA as a quote unquote over the hill champion who twice was just handed the world title rather than winning it in a tournament or in a number one contenders match. However, the more they go back and watch his stuff, whether it's the Kurt Hennig match in the late 80s or Jerry Lawler matches or the Houston matches or just random AWA title matches, the more they realize how good he was in his 40s and 50s. And, you know, he had been in the business for 20 or 30 years by that point. So, of course, he had a great track record, but he was not broken down. He did play, I guess, the over-the-hill champion who you just know that the young gun is going to get this time out, whether it was Rick Martel or Tito Santana or Hulk Hogan or Greg Gagne or Jim Brunzel or, you know, guys his age or close to his age that were quote unquote better wrestlers or tougher guys than Bockwinkel, like the Crusher or the Bruiser. But somehow Bockwinkel with his cagey ways always managed to defend the title. And I, like I said, I didn't quite appreciate it at the time when I was not enjoying AWA wrestling in 85, 86. However, come to find out and come to watch a bunch of old matches from Houston in particular and realize that this guy really had something special going on. And that's why he was, you know, longtime AWA champion. And before that, longtime AWA tag team champion with Ray Stevens. So in 1980, Nick does not appear in Houston. And I think one of the reasons for that is that he loses the title midway through the year. July 18th, 1980 in Comiskey Park, Vern Gagne on his comeback tour, I guess you would say, at age 54, if I have that correct, beats Bockwinkel for the title, has his final title reign. It lasts 10 months. He has what's supposed to be or what is his retirement match, May 10th, 1981 in St. Paul at the Civic Center. And instead of doing the honors and putting over Bockwinkel, he goes out as champion, which, I mean, it was his federation and he was the longtime champion. Guess he had every right to do. So he does win the match and retires again. However, 9 days later, at least according to what I've read, your mileage may vary based on when they actually put the return on TV, but Nick Bockwinkel is given the title back as the number one contender to the crown. No tournament, no number one contenders match, just what I presume is Stanley Blackburn awarding Nick the title. I don't think that was a great booking angle, but, you know, as I've said many times, I don't think the AWA was very well booked in the 1980s. So it's not a huge surprise, I guess you would say. One interesting thing about Nick getting the title back is just a few days before that, he loses a match to Tito Santana, which is pretty classic booking. So, you know, whatever my faults are with the AWA booking, they did hit on something that was a normally good booking idea, which is right before a champion or soon to be champion wins a title, he loses a couple of matches to people who will be the number one contenders. So most of Tito Santana's 1981 is spent in the AWA as a challenger to Bockwinkel, but he does end up in Houston, as we'll talk about in just a little while. But another setup to what's going on in Houston at this time is another big show that is promoted by Paul Bosch. And this one is set for April 17th, 1981. And Harley Race is supposed to defend the title against Mr. USA Tony Atlas. However, Harley Race no-shows the event. And I have heard it said that this time the no-show was expected. If you guys remember, the first time it's an accident in that in 1977, it's a summit show in the afternoon on a Sunday. It starts at 3 p.m. It's supposed to have all the world champions in one place. Superstar Billy Graham is there. Nick Bockwinkle is there. The Fabulous Moolah is there. And Harley Race is supposed to be there defending against Terry Funk. However, he quote unquote had it in his head that it was a 7:30 show. And so he shows up in a cab right as the fans are emptying the arena. And instead of Race wrestling Terry Funk, Nick Bockwinkle, who has already had a 20-minute time limit draw with Jose Lothario, wrestles to a 60-minute time limit draw with Terry Funk. And that so impressed Paul Bosch and Houston Wrestling that they end up booking Bockwinkle for the next 3 years, about 8, 10, 12 times a year to come in and defend his title. He's not in Houston in 1980, as I mentioned. However, he does return in 1981, as we'll talk about in just a minute. But to wrap up the Harley Race saga, Paul Bosch and other people have said that this time they expected the Harley Race was not going to show up. They had just switched from a longtime association with the Dallas Wrestling Office and Fritz Von Erich being their booking office to working with Joe Blanchard's Southwest Championship Wrestling. And the reason for this, Paul Bosch has said, and his nephew Pete Burkle says in his book, When Wrestling Was Wrestling, shout out to the wrestling reference, that ratings were down, attendance was down, the talent in the Dallas booking office was not what it used to be. Channel 39, which is the UHF station that ran Houston Wrestling, had canceled the Sunday morning show in an effort to increase the ratings on Saturday night, which in the office they thought was folly because they didn't think that the same people watched the show on Saturday night that watched the show Sunday morning. However, in an effort to get things back to an acceptable level, they decide to break off their long-standing relationship with the Dallas office and go with Joe Blanchard and Southwest Championship Wrestling. At the time, apparently booked by Wahoo McDaniel. So maybe that is the glory era that I'm looking for, spring of 1981 in Southwest. But also they're affiliated with the Funks and just a whole host of different talent from that era. And so 1981 starts with that switch. And because Fritz Von Erich had been the president of the NWA, and because Harley Race had a good relationship with Fritz Von Erich, the people in Houston believe that Harley Race no-showed the April 17th match on purpose as retaliation. However, Paul Bosch seems to hate no-shows more than anything else in the world. And, you know, as a promoter or even a wrestling fan, you can understand why. If you're going all out to promote somebody as being there and they don't show up, it hurts your reputation. Paul Bosch had a stellar reputation. He was not one of those guys that promoted matches that didn't take place. I'm looking at you, Nick Gulas. However, this was the second no-show. Paul Bosch was livid. And so he goes out to the crowd and announces that after 35 years, of being associated with the NWA. Morris Siegel, his predecessor in Houston, is believed to have been one of the pioneer members, if not a founding member of the NWA. And so at this point in 1981, Houston Wrestling says that they're going to leave the NWA. They will no longer be part of the National Wrestling Alliance, and they will promote on their own. The card that is scheduled for that day was changed on the fly. And instead of promoting, obviously, the Harley Race versus Tony Atlas match, they instead have a one-night tournament to crown the world champion. I put that in parentheses because it's sort of the world champion of Houston, if you know what I mean. I'm not sure where else the world champion was going to defend his title at that point, since he's not affiliated with any other promotions except maybe Southwest. But they do have a one-night tournament. I don't have all of the results, but I do know that in the semifinals, Terry Funk defeats Tony Atlas. I believe Wahoo McDaniel defeats Dory Funk Jr. And then in the finals, Wahoo beats Terry Funk. Now, in Pete Burkle's book, he says that they did offer refunds and only 28 fans asked for a refund. And perhaps he implies when they saw the TV the next week and saw how exciting the tournament was, they regretted getting their money back. The next month, there is a rematch, or there is a match between Wahoo McDaniel and Nick Bockwinkel. And I actually own the wrestling program from the match before, from Friday, May 15th, 1981. And for those of you that have never seen a Houston wrestling program, the front cover was usually to set up the next set of matches. So inside, you'll have all the stories about what's going to happen at that night's wrestling show, including the card. But a lot of times, the story on the front of the program sets up what is going to happen the next matches. And in this case, and I'll post this, the next Coliseum card is Friday, May 29th. Sensational card in the making. Title claimants meet. Wahoo and Nick Bockwinkel clash in final match. And here's what they say. Wahoo McDaniel, who is recognized here as the heavyweight champion of the world, will take on a man that a number of officials consider the best wrestler in the world, Nick Bockwinkel, in a savage showdown of tremendous importance for the entire wrestling world. That showdown will take place in the Coliseum on Friday, May 29th. Wahoo McDaniel's recognition as the true world champion is quickly spreading, and if the Indian Chief can defeat Bockwinkel, then his recognition should become worldwide. Since winning the one-night tournament that crowned him the new champion after Harley Race deliberately ran out on his contract, Wahoo has been traveling throughout the country establishing his claim and meeting the toughest competition in each arena, in each area. Now he faces his toughest challenge yet, when he clashes with the arrogant but talented Nick Bockwinkel. The winner will be recognized as the champion of the world. It will be a match that will go down in wrestling history, and you should be part of that history. Which, I have to admit, it does make me want to go and go back to 1981 and see that match. Now, according to Pete Burkle's, after the match, Wahoo renounces his claim to the world championship, and in return is granted another match, this time for the AWA world title. The finish of the match is actually a third fall DQ, where Bockwinkel is DQ'd and Wahoo wins 2-1. So I'd like to know more about what changed. Maybe at that point they decide that they can work with Nick Bockwinkel as the world heavyweight champion. Maybe Wahoo has other plans and isn't going to be around much longer. Although, as you'll hear, he does wrestle Nick, I think, 4 times in Houston that year. And so we'll see if we can figure out more information about Wahoo McDaniel's brief run as world champion in Houston and why exactly he decides that he will relinquish the claim and instead challenge for Nick Bockwinkel's world heavyweight title. I will say that before he wins the world title back, Bockwinkel does have a Houston match Friday, April 4th. He wrestles Scott Casey and he wins 2-1. And then he returns for a non-title match Friday, May 8th against Ivan Putski. I believe it's 1-fall main event, and Bockwinkel does win this match. After the match against Wahoo McDaniel, Bockwinkel comes back Friday, July 24th, and he wrestles against Tony Atlas. And in this match, it is tied 1-fall apiece, and then it ends up going to a time limit draw. The interesting thing about this match is that Lou Thesz is the referee for this match. And I think this was a setup for Tony Atlas to finally get his world title match since he was cheated, quote unquote, out of a chance at Harley Race's world title. Friday, August 14th, Wahoo McDaniel gets another title shot against Nick Bockwinkel. And this time Bockwinkel wins 2-1 when McDaniel is counted out of the ring in the third fall. Friday, September 25th, Bockwinkel is back, and this time he is doing a week in Southwest, as we'll talk about in just a minute, and he defends in Houston against Bruiser Brody. He wins 2-1, but the third fall is a disqualification. Sunday, October 4th, Bockwinkel defends the title against the Junkyard Dog, so this is the beginning of the Mid-South sensation Junkyard Dog coming into Houston. And Bockwinkel again wins 2-1, but the third fall is a disqualification. And that brings us to October 30th, October 31st, and November 1st, or what is billed as the Gold Cup tournament. Now, on some level, I have more questions than answers about the Gold Cup tournament. Because, I don't know, the tournament itself is a little oddly sketched out or a little oddly drawn. And in the first 2 days of the tournament, Tito Santana is nowhere to be found. But on the third day of the tournament, Tito Santana is in the finals wrestling Nick Bockwinkel. And actually, Nick Bockwinkel brings this up in his interview with Paul Bosch to set up the November match. But I don't really understand it. And I've said this before. I'm one of the people that love tournament brackets in wrestling. Part of it is because I love the NCAA tournament. And I just always found it fascinating. From the very first time that I saw a quote unquote tournament promoted or a tournament bracket promoted, which is probably Georgia Championship Wrestling at the Omni on Thanksgiving night, one of the tag team tournaments. And I was fascinated with the odd pairings of people that would appear in these tournaments, and then fascinated with how people progressed through the brackets. I think maybe also I had seen some tournament brackets for the National Heavyweight Title Tournament, which was set up after Larry Zbyszko bought the title from Killer Tim Brooks, and then was stripped of the title, and then they had a tournament, and then Larry Zbyszko won the tournament. I think possibly cheated Mr. Wrestling 2 out of it, and so for a while, Mr. Wrestling 2 steals the belt and bills himself as the champion. But I digress. That's neither here nor there, because the point is just, I really loved these tournaments. And I've seen it said by Dave Meltzer and in other places that tournaments were not a very good draw. And I'm not sure why, because like I said, if you take 8 names or 16 names that are all main event guys or semi-main event guys, all big names in wrestling, and you draw them out of a hat and you match them up and they progress through the bracket, I find that endlessly fascinating. Now, maybe because of the lack of promoting a certain match, it's not as fascinating to the casual fan. But to me, if you say, hey, we're going to have a one-night tournament for this title, sign me up. That's exactly what I wanted to see. So I don't know what the difference is between the casual fan and my, you know, super fandom back in the day, but I love those sort of storylines. But what drives me crazy is the Bill Watts school of booking, where you can't sketch out a normal tournament bracket, where for some reason, instead of having 8 guys or 16 guys or 12 guys with first round buys, you have like 11 people in the tournament. And for some reason, one of the matches leads to the semifinals, but everybody else goes to the quarterfinals. And that is a little bit of a setup for the Gold Cup brackets, because I'm going to read you guys what Cage Match says are the results from the two nights of the tournament. So here is Friday, October 30th, 1981, the Gold Cup tournament. Scott Casey defeats the Spoiler. They have this as Don Jardine, but it is not the real Spoiler. Let's just say that. I'm not sure who it is, but it's not Don Jardine. Tiger Conway Jr. defeats Ray Hernandez, aka soon to be Hercules Hernandez. Tom Pritchard defeats Don Serrano. Moon Mulligan defeats Kelly Kaniski. Gene Kaniski, coming out of retirement, defeats Tank Patton. Mike Graham and Tully Blanchard go to a 20-minute time limit draw. Gino Hernandez and the Sheik go to a double countout. Manny Fernandez defeats Terry Allen, soon to be Magnum TA. Dick Slater defeats Evan Johnson. Dos Karras defeats Bull Ramos. And Nick Bockwinkel and Wahoo McDaniel go to a 20-minute time limit draw. So that is night number one of the Gold Cup tournament. Night number two of the Gold Cup tournament. And here we go. On Halloween night, October 31st, 1981, Scott Casey and Tank Patton go to a time limit draw. Tiger Conway Jr. defeats Kelly Kaniski. Manny Fernandez defeats Bull Ramos. Gene Kaniski defeats Moon Mulligan. Tom Pritchard defeats Nick Kozak, who is mostly a referee at this stage. Mike Graham defeats Don Serrano. Ken Patera defeats Evan Johnson. Dos Karras defeats Tully Blanchard by disqualification. Vern Gagne apparently has shown up, and he defeats Dick Slater. Gino Hernandez defeats Hiro Matsuda. Ernie Ladd is now here, and he defeats the Sheik by disqualification. And Nick Bockwinkel and Wahoo McDaniel have a rematch in which Nick Bockwinkel defeats Wahoo McDaniel. Make it make sense, because I can't make it make sense. However, on Sunday, November 1st, in what is listed on Cage Match as the only match that day, an afternoon match to crown the Gold Cup champion, and Tito Santana defeats Nick Bockwinkel. Now, in the November 20th, 1981 match, which is available on YouTube between Bockwinkel and Santana, Paul Bosch says that Santana won 3 matches in the Gold Cup tournament. But I have no idea when those matches took place, because as we have seen, he's not in the matches on October 30th or October 31st. And the only match that I can find listed for November 1st is that Santana beats Nick Bockwinkel. So you know how they say that every supervillain's backstory is a compelling story, that if you put yourself in his shoes, it makes sense to some extent. But the problem is he just goes too far and, you know, become super villainy, right? So in this case, Nick Bockwinkel is the heel. People are happy that he lost to Tito Santana. However, he has a grievance, right? Like, how did Tito Santana get into the finals of the Gold Cup? I don't understand, you know, where was Ernie Ladd? Where was Vern Gagne? Where was Gino Hernandez? Where was Dos Karras? Where was Ken Patera? Where was Gene Kaniski? Where was Manny Fernandez? Where was Scott Casey? I know Scott Casey has a draw, but none of those guys lost matches that I can see. However, none of them are in the Gold Cup tournament finals. So the only thing I can think is that they had some sort of ceremony and then people possibly picked who got to be in the finals. And that was Nick Bockwinkel and Tito Santana. But why would you pick Tito Santana? I don't know. It you know, it's sort of, like I said, it's in the make it make sense territory. And I don't know that it does make sense exactly. But, and then the other thing is that they keep saying in the rematch that Tito Santana won a decision from Nick Bockwinkel. So in my wrestling logic mind, that makes it sound like there wasn't actually a finish, that they went to a time limit draw or they went to a double disqualification, and somehow the, I don't even know what you would say, the judges maybe intervened and gave the match, awarded the match, judged the match on points to be, you know, won by Tito Santana. So I'm not sure. You know, As I said, sometimes not every match, especially the main event matches, is ends up on Houston Wrestling TV. And in this case, clearly there's not any footage that I can find of the Gold Cup matches. So we just have the interview that Bockwinkel does to set up the match on November 20th, which is a rematch with Santana. Now, strangely, a week before that match, Friday, November 13th, Bockwinkel is back defending the title against Dusty Rhodes. It appears to be a one-fall match, and Dusty wins by disqualification. I'm not sure why they went that route. Maybe Santana was not available that day, and so therefore they set up a different match. But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I will say that Dusty does come back again in the next couple of years and gets more title defenses against Bockwinkel. As we know, as you've heard, as I've heard, Dusty did like to come and wrestle in Houston because his mom was there. And so he would call up and say, it's time for me to visit mom. And they would set it up so that he could, you know, get flown in and make some money, but still be there to visit with his mom. So maybe it's just, it was time to visit mama, as he would say. I got to say, that is one of the neat things about professional wrestling that I really like from back in the day, from the territory era. Like, guys would just decide to take their families on a Florida beach vacation. And so they would call the Florida office and say, hey, can you get me some bookings for a couple of weeks? And so they would come down and stay on the beach, and the family would enjoy the beach. And meanwhile, dad would be off wrestling throughout Florida for a week. Endlessly fascinating, the way that the territory system used to work, and the way that guys moved around, and the way that they all seemed to have known one another or wrestled with one another. And it's almost like a story when people say, yeah, I never wrestled him, or yeah, our paths never really crossed, because most of the time it does seem like everybody's path has crossed several different times. And, you know, to illustrate this, there is a picture making the rounds today, August 31st, as I record this, on Twitter and on Facebook, and it is Dennis Condrey and Stan Lane as a tag team, right? The two partners of Bobby Eaton in the Midnight Express, who somehow, some way, for a short time period in Georgia, were also tag team partners. And I just find that fascinating as well. There is no doubt that you know, guys made the rounds. And, you know, it's funny, we think of everybody as like all one big happy family, but then you watch, you know, people snipe at each other on the shoot interviews, or you hear about fights, or, you know, whatever the case may be. And you realize that a lot of these guys were not one big happy family. A lot of these guys were rivals, whether it was over money or main event spots or women, you know, whatever the case may be. It didn't always seem like everybody got along, but somehow they all seemed to know one another. They all seemed to wrestle against one another here and there. And I don't know. Like I said, I just find that fascinating. So whatever the reason, Dusty Rhodes is in Houston Wrestling for a title shot against Nick Bockwinkel on November 13th. It goes to a DQ. Dusty will come back another time, but in the interim, it sets up the match where we heard a little bit of the interview, Nick Bockwinkel against Tito Santana. And this is actually not for Nick's title. This is for the Gold Cup tournament championship. So that was interesting as well. Nick wants the Gold Cup trophy. He says something very funny in the interview, in which he says that he's going to wrestle Tito in his home country. And that just made me laugh out loud, because at first you think he means Mexico, and why is he saying that he's going to wrestle Tito Santana in Mexico? But he means Texas. Tito Santana is billed as being from Mission, Texas. And I guess Bockwinkel meant home state. I'm going to wrestle you in your home state. But he doesn't say that. He says your home country. And so that was pretty interesting. And so the match itself is one of those matches that in my mind is just a fantastic classic match. And it goes 2 of 3 falls. The first fall is about 20 minutes. And Tito goes for a flying head scissors against the turnbuckle. Bockwinkel ducks. Tito crashes full body into the turnbuckle and then is pinned for the first fall. Really good booking in that. Bockwinkel is ahead 1-0. How is Tito going to retain his Gold Cup trophy now? Well, about 5 minutes later, we find out, as Tito has been just beaten on for the 5 minutes of the second fall, but he ducks a clothesline, goes into the ropes, comes off the ropes with a flying body press, and evens the match at 1 fall apiece. And I feel a lot like an old timer for saying this, but I love that finish. I love the flying body press. And I really, to me, I sort of miss that era when something a little simpler could be the finish, when you didn't have to do 20 big moves to get a finish. Boy, do I sound like Adrian Street talking about the Tiger Mask and Dynamite Kid match. But I just love that it's something as simple as coming off the top rope with a flying body press, or coming off the ropes in this case with a flying body press, and getting the pin. So that's what happens in the second fall. And then in the third fall, about 5 minutes later, Santana is thrown out of the ring. He's thrown into the ring post. He sort of hides his head under the ring and does a blade job, comes up bloody. Bockwinkel is beating on him, won't let him back in the ring. But Santana gets the shoulder into Bockwinkel. Bockwinkel falls back. I wonder if it was supposed to be a sunset flip, but Bockwinkel takes the bump way back into the ring, comes charging back at Santana, and Santana then does another body press, this time over the top rope into Bockwinkel, gets the 1-2-3. What Paul Bosch bills as Tito Santana's family hits the ring. They say that his brother is in the ring celebrating with him. And the crowd is, you know, just going crazy, lapping it up as Santana gets a win over the AWA World Heavyweight Champion. However, it's a non-title match. The match was actually for Santana's Gold Cup trophy. And the good news is that this does set up another rematch. And this time it's the end of the year, December 27th, 1981. This time it is for the World Heavyweight title. 2 out of 3 falls, but it goes to a 60-minute time limit draw. That is Bockwinkel's Sam Houston Coliseum matches in 1981. I do want to go down the rest of the card for the November 20th, 1981 matches. In the opener, Scott Casey defeats Tank Patton. Tiger Conway Jr. defeats Tom Pritchard. Manny Fernandez defeats Buck Robley. Dory Funk Jr. beats Moon Mulligan by disqualification. The Southwest tag team titles are on the line as the dynamic duo, Gina Hernandez and Tully Blanchard, go to a double disqualification against Dos Karras and Mil Máscaras. And then in the Gold Cup Trophy Challenge match, as we said, Tito beats Nick Bockwinkel 2 falls to 1 in about 32 minutes total. And that match, as I said, is available on YouTube. You can check it out. I just think it's a great, great match. Now, I did say that I wanted to talk about Bockwinkel in 1981 in general. So we'll do a little rundown, as we did last time, of some of his other matches. In the AWA, in this era, he is defending against Billy Robinson, Dino Bravo, Greg Gagne, Pat O'Connor, Jim Brunzell, Baron von Raschke, who I think is a babyface at this point in time, but maybe it was a heel versus heel match. A lot of the matches I'm looking at seem to have Baron against Bockwinkel and Crusher Blackwell, or Bockwinkel and other Sheik Adnan Al-Kaisi wrestlers, managed wrestlers. So I wonder if the Baron is actually a good guy at this time and getting title shots at Bockwinkel as the babyface. There are a couple of title defenses against Pat Patterson in Oakland, which I found fascinating, back in the San Francisco market after the San Francisco territory has folded, but coming back with big stars of the era. And actually, there's 2 matches where Bockwinkel defends against Pat Patterson. And then in between those 2 matches, Bockwinkel defends against Rock and Roll Buck Zumhoff, which seems like it would be quite a letdown. However, what seems to be the actual main event on that card is the return of Pat Patterson and Ray Stevens as a tag team, and they get a tag team title match with the East-West connection, Jesse Ventura and Adrian Adonis. So that actually sounds like a match I would like to see. I'm sure you guys, a lot of you guys, feel the same way. That seems like a fascinating match to watch. And, you know, again, I don't know why Buck Zumhoff was getting title defenses in 1981, but, you know, I mean, I guess the same could be said for Nick Bockwinkel wrestling Scott Casey, or Nick Bockwinkel wrestling Johnny Rich, which he does in Houston in 1983. We'll talk about on a future episode. And then another weird thing in the AWA is that Sheik Adnan Al-Kaisi gets a couple of title shots against Nick Bockwinkel in 1981. So was Nick a tweener at the time, or was he just getting, you know, was he cheered? I mean, I'm sure he was cheered against the Sheik, right? In any event, something that we'll look into, or someone will fill us in that knows more about the AWA at some point in the future. As we talked about in Houston, Bockwinkel wrestles Scott Casey, Ivan Putski, Wahoo McDaniel 4 times, Tony Atlas to a time limit draw, Bruiser Brody, and the Junkyard Dog. In Southwest, and he does a couple of weeks in Southwest, including stopping in for Houston matches. again, wrestles Scott Casey in a couple of places. Odessa, Texas is one of them. He wrestles a TV match against Relampago Leon, who Gene Kelly insists must be one of the finest athletes to ever come out of Mexico, which I am still making fun of every time I watch Gene Kelly now, or every time I see any of the great Mexican wrestlers who are wrestling on Southwest Championship Wrestling in that era, including Mil Máscaras, who gets a title shot against Nick Bockwinkel in San Antonio in this era. And Manny Fernandez gets a title shot against Nick Bockwinkel, actually on my birthday, September 26th, 1981, in San Antonio. Another thing that I found fascinating from this era is that Bockwinkel is in Calgary for a week. And during that time, he defends the world heavyweight title against Bret Hart. And that was a little earlier than I remember that Bret Hart was one of the stars of Calgary. But again, I'm not an expert on Calgary wrestling. So, you know, maybe Bret was already getting a big push as, you know, the young son of Bruce, of Stu Hart. I almost said Bruce Hart. I did say Bruce Hart, right? As the son of Stu Hart, the new up-and-comer, baby-faced, fresh-faced Hart son who is tearing it through the ranks, much as they do later on in, what is it, 1989 with Owen Hart, where he's just getting a push right out of the gate. There's some really interesting matches that Bockwinkel has in Calgary, and we'll talk about those again in a future episode when we get into 1982 and 1983 and where Bockwinkel is. But I'm just fascinated with the matches against Bret Hart. And I might even have a Calgary program from that era where he's defending against Bret Hart. I'll have to look. Mostly, as you guys know, I'm into the Houston wrestling programs, but occasionally I find something that's just a good bargain. And I think maybe when I was researching Nick Bockwinkel, I was trying to get some of his other ones. I know I have one where he's defending against David Schultz. And again, I don't know who the babyface is in that match. I think David Schultz is a heel during his time in Calgary, but I can't swear to that. Or I can't swear that he was always the heel. Maybe they turn him at some point. Or maybe it's just, you know, typical AWA, NWA traveling world champion comes in and defends against all comers. And David Schultz happened to be the North American champion at the time or the number one contender at the time. And he got some title shots. But in 1981, instead, Bockwinkel is defending the title against Bret Hart. And like I said, I just find that fascinating. I would love to see some of those matches as well. And then something that I also thought was interesting is that in 1981, Bockwinkel goes to Germany for what I believe is the first time. And he defends his title against Otto Wanz. Now, he doesn't lose the title to Wanz at this time. They actually go to a time limit draw. December 19th, 1981, in Bremen, Germany. So I thought that was interesting, sort of setting the stage for Wanz winning the title in 1982. Now, the post-Christmas show in Houston, we'll run down that lineup real quick. December 27th, 1981, Manny Fernandez defeats Tank Patton. The Grappler makes an appearance and defeats Tom Pritchard. Tiger Conway Jr. defeats Buck Robley and Moon Mulligan. Dick Slater defends the Southwest heavyweight title against Tully Blanchard and gets the win. Bruiser Brody wins the Southwest Championship Brass Knuckles title against Gino Hernandez. And then Santana and Bockwinkel go to the 60-minute time limit draw. That sounds like a really good card. Even if you take the Buck Robley and Moon Mulligan and Tank Patton out of it, at least they're in their place on the bottom of the card. But the last three matches sound like they were all
really good Slater and Blanchard, Brody and Hernandez, and obviously the 60-minute draw where Santana gets a title shot against Nick Bockwinkel. Can I digress for a minute and just say I find it really amusing when people say that brass knuckles titles were the late 70s, early 80s version of a TV title. Because the TV title had an express purpose, which was that it was quote unquote supposed to be defended on TV, right? And if you didn't beat the champ in 10 minutes or 15 minutes, whatever it was, then you didn't get to win the title. And sometimes you'd win right after the time limit expired so that, you know, it would set up an arena match or the rematch or whatever the case may be. A brass knuckles title doesn't really feel like a secondary title. It feels like a tough guy title. And, you know, hence it seemed to always be held by somebody like Bruiser Brody or Bob Sweetan. And I know, like, Bob Sweetan, not a good human being, but, you know, we talk about him a lot in Southwest and Houston and Mid-South. And, you know, I can remember in the 70s, like, Bill Watts and Bob Sweetan are feuding over the brass knuckles title. Bruiser Brody is feuding with people over the brass knuckles title. I've never seen a match where they actually have brass knuckles. Now, again, I haven't seen a whole lot of brass knuckles title defenses, but there's a few on the Houston, you know, YouTube channel or the NWA pay-per-view channel or Crispy Lettuce's Google Drive. But it seems more like a bunkhouse match or an anything goes match rather than necessarily like the secondary title for your number two babyface. It's not the Intercontinental title that, you know, Santana and Savage and Greg Valentine and Ultimate Warrior and those kind of guys hold. It seems more like the guy that quote unquote doesn't need a title because he's a tough guy, but now we have a title for the tough guys. And so it's going to be somebody like Bruiser Brody who holds the title. That's one of those things that just kind of goes away in the early 80s. I think the last I remember seeing any of them are maybe 1981, 1982. And by 1983, it doesn't seem like anybody still has a brass knuckles champion. Do you think they meant bare knuckles champion or closed fist? You know, you're allowed to punch with closed fist champions. Or maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there is actually somewhere, some match where there is brass knuckles. Maybe it's brass knuckles on a pole, or maybe you can tape up your fists and, you know, the gimmick, you know, the donut hole gimmick where you say that you've got a foreign object, but you don't really have a foreign object. I'm not exactly sure. But just one of those relics of the past, I guess, that I found fascinating. And I'm sure as we continue to explore old school wrestling talk, we will learn more about brass knuckles titles and who held brass knuckles titles and why they were created and why they went away. One of those mysteries. But today we were talking about Nick Bockwinkel in Houston wrestling and Nick Bockwinkel as a traveling world champion. And as I said in episode number 5, I just find Nick Bockwinkel in Houston an endlessly fascinating story because it opened the door for me to appreciate Nick Bockwinkel more and to realize that he wasn't just an AWA champion. He was actually a traveling world champion who in other years was not only in Houston or Southwest or Calgary, but was in Memphis, was in Mid-Atlantic, was in Georgia, was in California. And really, there are a lot of guys that I did not realize that Nick Bockwinkel defended the AWA world title against. You know, you can say that, of course, he defended against Billy Robinson and the Gagnas and Jim Brunzel and Hulk Hogan and Rick Martel and Crusher and Bruiser and Baron, but you know, did you know that he defended against Tommy Rich and Mr. Wrestling 2 and Ricky Steamboat and Bruiser Brody and Rocky Johnson and Scott Casey and Ivan Putski and Wahoo McDaniel and Tony Atlas? And as we talked about today, that he had matches in Houston against Tito Santana. Now, Tito Santana was in the AWA mostly at this time, so we do know that he was getting title defenses there as well. And as we talked about, right before Bockwinkel is given the title back, he loses to Santana in a match in Green Bay to set up what is
a big year of Tito Santana challenging Nick Bockwinkel for the AWA World Heavyweight title. He never gets there. He loses most of the blow-off matches, we're going to assume by cheating, but he never does lose in Houston. He defeats Bockwinkel twice in the Gold Cup and then in the Gold Cup rematch. And then when the match is for the AWA World Heavyweight title, they go to a time limit draw. Santana does show up in Southwest in 1981. Interesting to me that they go out of their way to highlight both him and Ivan Putski as former WWF tag team champions, or was it WWWF tag team champions? But they talk a lot about how these guys were the finest tag team in New York for a while, and they held the World Heavyweight Tag Team titles in New York, or in the World Wrestling Federation, or in the World Wide Wrestling Federation. And I just think, man, they really use that as a selling point, possibly to their detriment a few years later when they are feuding over the USA Network and when they get kicked off the USA Network and replaced by Vince's wrestling with his ambition to go national. Maybe somebody should have seen it coming. Obviously, they didn't see it coming in 1981 because Vince had not taken over. Vince Jr. had not taken over the company at that point in time, but just really interesting. And I'll wrap up with one more Southwest note because I have been continuing my watching of Southwest Championship Wrestling, but I saw a great television match between Ricky Morton and Ken Wayne, soon to be of the Nightmares. And again, I know, not a good human being, still possibly in jail for some of his offenses with young women. But it is a fantastic TV match. And as we talked about last month, Ken Wayne comes into Houston for a couple of matches where he's just basically doing the job. But I really thought at that point, when I was watching the Southwest match, I wish that I could see more matches between the Nightmares, aka the Galaxians, and the Rock and Roll Express. And I know some matches exist in Memphis. I'm not sure how many of them are on TV, but that would have been a good feud in 1983, 1984. And I just wish that they had stayed in the same place, or that the Nightmares had come into Houston or Mid-South at that time, or that the Rock and Roll Express had spent a little time in Alabama. That seems so funny to say. Of course, when they are the Toast of Crockett, they're not going to go to Continental and wrestle the Nightmares, but two really good teams. And the Nightmares, just unbelievably underrated for that era because they didn't end up in a big federation. They were mostly in Alabama or for a little while in Memphis. But if you get a chance to check it out, it's in the 1982 Southwest section of Chris P. Lettuce's Google Drive. In any event, this has been episode 7, September 1st edition of Greg Klein's Old School Wrestling Talk. In another month, we will look at Nick Bockwinkel in 1982 and 1983. But until then, thank you guys for listening. And thank you guys for supporting the show. Thank you guys for buying my books. Thank you guys for being fans of the Old School Wrestling Talk. We will see you next month with a new episode of Greg Klein's Old School Wrestling Talk.